We will call the Resource Committee back to order. Many of those who had wished to testify today are either in Sitka or in Yakutat. Maybe they'll make it for tomorrow's testimony in the Finance Committee room. The first one is Phil Holdsworth. Yes, it is. It's already on. That's their mic. And you'll just have to speak up because we get some other ones.
For the record, my name is Phil Holdsworth, and I'm speaking for the Southeastern Conference. The Southeastern Conference is a conference made up of representation from 14 Southeastern communities, members of the Chambers of Commerce and the Municipal Governments. And at the 24th Annual Conference, which is, means it's a long-time organization, held last September, on their policy statement is item 3 was hydroelectric energy, and I would like to briefly read that particular statement. The conference advocates that the state of Alaska endorse the concept that the provision of an adequate source of energy at a reasonable cost is in its own best interest, and further, the state of Alaska endorses the concept that hydroelectric energy is the most advantageous method of generating renewable electric power for use by many citizens of Alaska, and further, that the state of Alaska assure the uninterrupted continuance of loan funds through legislative and administrative procedure for feasible hydroelectric projects within the state of Alaska, and further, that the state of Alaska take recognition of the immediate financing problems of the hydroelectric energy projects within the state, which have arisen as a result of the constraints of higher interest rates and shorter-term financing conditions existing in the money markets, and which will prevent the completion of many of these projects, and that this recognition be either in the form of direct, long-term, low-interest loans for the construction of these projects, or in a form which will directly offset the increased costs resulting from the herein mentioned constraints. And further, that the financing mechanism for the resolution of these problems, for these hydroelectric and other energy projects, be supported from the revenues presently being generated by state oil and gas revenues, which are non-renewable resources. And further, that there be could be no wiser investment by the state of Alaska than an investment which, by its very nature, would benefit all citizens of the state of Alaska. Now, as you can see, that policy statement pretty well fits Senate Bill 25 and 26. And I would like to just repeat what others have said in the testimony and teleconferencing, that I feel that Section 1 of the bill very clearly spells out economic feasibility and does retain some control over the Alaska Power Authority. Feasibility has to be proven, and in a feasibility study, they have to consider any other form, alternative forms of power, and their costs. And I think the guidelines laid out in Section 1 very well do put that control on. Now, for the benefit of previous witness in Fairbanks, who asked about Snettisham Phase 2, Snettisham Phase 2 would be connecting a second lake, Lake Dorothy, to the existing power plant by the use of a tunnel. And the power plant was designed and was built to room for installation of additional turbines to take this extra flow from this second lake, very large lake. And that's why the amounts required are not very large. And it would be, when the time comes, if this is needed, why this would be a very, very easy way to double the capacity of that present plant. All I have.
Do any members of the committee have questions? Thank you very much, Phil. Roland Shanks.
I
Good afternoon, I'm Roland Shanks. I'm representing the Alaska Environmental Lobby. And I'd like to thank the committee for the opportunity to discuss this issue today. We feel that the hydroelectric potential of Alaska is an important resource. It can play a major role in the future of Alaska. It provides the opportunity to move away from an energy future tied to non-renewable fossil fuels and to develop clean, renewable energy sources. But we feel that hydroelectric needs to be dealt with in an overall context of energy planning. We must determine the future we seek for our state before we can determine the proper energy source. Energy has become such an important commodity that it can shape the entire future of our state. Last year, a report by the House Research Agency identified 35 departments, divisions, offices, and authorities working on energy matters. This has led to overlap and duplication. We feel that the responsibilities need to be more clearly defined. We do not feel that there is a need for a super energy agency. We feel that it is important to maintain the separation of agencies to maintain a check and balance system. It is important that energy decisions receive close scrutiny and that they fit into the projected future of Alaska. I think today that we are addressing the issue of whether we want Alaska to remain a diverse, self-reliant society or to move towards a centralized, homogeneous society. I'd like to make the following specific comments about the legislation you're considering today. HB 8. We feel that it is very premature to appropriate money to start construction of the Susitna River Hydroelectric Project. In the past, the legislature has appropriated $31 million to study the feasibility of Susitna and possible alternatives. The governor has requested approximately $12 million to complete those studies. It does not seem a wise use of public money to fund studies of a project and then to fund that project before the studies are completed. The Susitna issue has been debated many times, and we all know the arguments pro and con. We feel that the decision to expend money for the Susitna project should await the outcome of the studies. Sponsor substitute for SB 25 and SB 26. I'll address these bills together since one establishes a revolving loan fund and the other appropriates the money. The economic feasibility test established in Section 1 should be restructured to better reflect a truer economic perspective. A general inflation rate of 7% seems very low, while an escalation factor of 11% seems high. In Section 2, a power project revolving fund is established. We believe that there may be a preferable funding system. We believe that the state money should be used to underwrite loans to provide the equity needed to enter the conventional bond market. This system would provide us two important benefits. It would ensure an objective fiscal review of the project by the bond underwriters. These are people who make their living investing other people's money in large projects. This would bring the cold eye of an investment advisor to these projects. The bond market would also allow us to spread our money further. By not providing 100% financing to all the projects, we could use less money to provide more projects. This would leave more money to fund other capital improvements needed in the state. We are also concerned about the authority being able to fund projects without legislative approval. Because of the importance of the power project decisions and the amount of money involved, we feel that the legislature should retain that decision-making power. Under this plan, the legislature would lose control of almost $5 billion in some of the most important decisions in the future of the state. We also feel that the funds should be available to finance private energy sources or projects proposed by cooperatives or other groups. We are also troubled by the loan terms and conditions. An interest rate of 3% over 5 years is tantamount to giving the money away. At current inflation rates, the return to the state could drop as low as 5 cents on the dollar. Therefore, this represents more of an appropriation than a loan. If this is viewed as an investment, it is not an investment that would be recommended by a prudent investment counselor. This makes the decision even more important. This will also be an unfair competitive advantage to large projects. This will keep Alaska in its historic cycle of boom and bust. It will also foster large centralized projects. These projects have historically brought in large amounts of outside labor and material and only minimally benefiting local economies. It may be well in the economic best interest of the state to foster an in-state economy based on energy conservation, retrofitting, and smaller, more localized projects. Because of the funding system would also lead to projects that far outstrip demand. Again, let me encourage you to decide this issue in the context of Alaska's future. Today we stand on the edge of the future. We possess the resources, both natural and physical, to enter that future as a strong, far-thinking state if we invest those resources wisely to ensure our future and the future of Alaska is yet to be born. Thank you.
Thank you, Roland. Any questions on part of the committee? Dave Hutchins?
Thank you, Sam.
President of Ferry Camp Committee. For the record, my name is David Hutchins. I'm Executive Director of the Alaska Rural Electric Cooperative Association. Our association is composed of 14 consumer-owned electric utilities across the state of Alaska. The opposition that's been expressed today to Senate Bill 8, I think largely misses the point, because I think people generally who have stated opposition have misunderstand what Senate Bill 8 is all about. Of course, the feasibility study comes first. And of course, you have to have the FERC license before you can proceed. That's federal law. And the situation, though, is that at the present time, while there is money available from non-renewable sources, it seems prudent to set aside some of that money for use if and when the FERC license is granted, and that would come only after the studies have all been completed and this is sitting a project that's found to be the most feasible of all of the alternatives to serve the rail belt area. Of course, these have to come first. But this is just a matter of setting some money aside, putting it in the bank so that it can be used if and when that does prove to be the most feasible project for the area. In any event, the purposes served by Senate Bill 8 are encompassed in the comprehensive program for hydroelectric energy development contained in Senate Bills 25 and 26. And it's primarily on these two bills that I want to speak today. I think the concept behind these two pieces of legislation is quite important. And as I read them, the basic concept is, first of all, that you'll use non-renewable revenue produced by non-renewable energy sources to finance permanent renewable sources, the development of renewable resources, primarily hydro, and do it at low interest rates so that the people of the state can truly benefit. It's a unified program with benefits across the state. The projects listed in Senate Bill 26 do cover a great percentage of the state, and testimony earlier today has indicated that covers 7/8 of the state population. It also recognizes that there are areas not covered by this, that other 1/8 of the state's population. In at least some cases, the rest of the population are in areas that do not have this type of resource available, or at least it is not proved at this point that it's there haven't been enough studies done on it, let's say, to make it worthwhile to name them at this point. And until similar resources can be found in these other areas, the Power Production Cost Assistance Program is essential to keep these people from literally freezing in the dark. We're approaching 50 cents per kilowatt hour in villages. And that is reduced in effective rate at the homeowner level by the Power Production Cost Assistance Program. It's reduced to approximately 25 cents per kilowatt hour. Now, one of the witnesses today remarked that he was opposed to this because he didn't want anything to interfere with the pricing signals to urge conservation. Well, I submit to you that 25 cents a kilowatt hour is adequate pricing signal to conserve. Another basic feature of this program is to fund these projects at today's cost with today's money and put the money aside where it can be invested, and the income from those investments will accrue to those funds so that there will be adequate funds available to pay for these projects whenever the time is right that they should be built. For example, Snettisham Phase 2, it's going to be quite a number of years before that is needed. It'll be a great project whenever the load demands require its construction. But by setting the money aside now, it can be invested, and you can stay even with inflation, so you'll have the money to build it when the time comes that it's needed. And another basic part of this package is that if a named project proves not to be feasible, the money is then available to finance other projects to serve that same area. For example, the Susitna project is the one that's received the most flack today. Well, perhaps it will be proved not to be the most feasible project to serve the Rail Belt area. If that should be the case, then the money would be available for the coal generation or whatever proves to be the more feasible project to serve the area. But at least today's money would be set aside to serve the needs of that area at the appropriate time. The previous speaker questioned the wisdom of investment in hydro. I would submit to you that investment in energy resources is the one of the wisest investments that could possibly be made. And he also suggested that there's an unfair advantage in large projects. Well, I don't know that it's unfair, but yes, there is an advantage, an economic advantage in large projects because they're more efficient. There's less investment required per kilowatt of capacity in larger projects. That's why there's an advantage for them. Several witnesses suggested that a mechanism needs to be used to retain the bond market in this program. This is simply a way to ensure that the financing costs are going to be high. The idea that they've used in advocating that is that you need the discipline of making sure that the project really is feasible, that you're not just financing something at 3% that is largely feasible. Actually, the Senate Bill 25 provides that it has to be proved to be feasible, assuming a 10% rate of interest. And then it would be the money would be loaned at 3%. There's a good deal of discussion today about removing legislative approval requirement on these projects. As I understand the intent of that, that was to take advantage of the exemption enacted by the legislature last year for those projects that are 1.5 megawatts or smaller, where they're exempted from the legislative scrutiny, so that the power authority would have the authority to proceed with those projects whenever they are proved to be feasible. Thanks.
Madam Chairman.
Yes.
Mr. Hutchins, of the 13 projects that are listed in Senate Bill 826, could you indicate to me which ones of those are the most likely to proceed in construction phase?
Yes, sir. I could give you a rough idea on the time chronology of these. Green Lake and Solomon Gulch are now under construction. I would say that next on the list in order of time would be Swan Lake, and then after that would come...
Excuse me, what year would that be?
Well, Swan Lake already has their FERC license to construct, and the construction has not begun. And then next after that would be Terror Lake and Tyee Lake on about the same time schedule, and Senator Fisher, that is... they both have submitted full documentation with their application for FERC license and expect to receive FERC license sometime during this year. And,
Madam Chair, may I interrupt again? Hey, does that mean they could, if this money were appropriated, they could go ahead this year with construction?
I doubt that the construction could start this year because I think in both cases it would probably be summer before they get their license to construct. Although some work can probably begin this year, no significant construction would really begin until next year, but it would permit them to go ahead and place orders and enter into contracts.
Madam Chair, if possible, Dave, if you could just sort of indicate when each of these projects might actually get going in construction, it might be helpful.
All right. I would say that Terror Lake and Tyee Lake, you could put a construction date beginning in 82 at the latest for both of those. And Black Bear Lake, maybe 82, but probably 83. And Bradley Lake, I'm not really sure under this kind of financing program exactly what the schedule would be on that. I think Senator Gilman might have more information on that than I have, but...
probably 1983.
83 also. And the others are further downstream in time, that it'd be difficult to pin a specific year on them for starting construction.
Thank you. Madam Chair, I'd like to point out to Senator Fisher that in regard to Terror Lake, that
if the license is granted this summer as expected, they're ready to go to bid the next day. So they'd be a go to bid, and I think the same thing probably applies to Tyee.
Yes.
Actual construction might not start till next spring, but they'd go to bid and award the bids, and the process is immediately. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Any other questions?
I have a couple of questions, Madam Chair. Did I understand correctly that you said that the $48 million is to be appropriated so Sidna could go ahead when the feasibility finding is made?
That's the way I understand it, yes.
Then I was wondering why this act takes effect immediately, that gives it
a feeling of urgency. That gets the money out of the general fund. Sets it aside so that it is earmarked for this project. It keeps it from being spent for other purposes.
Vic, the bill would not have, Madam Chair, would not have to pass both houses before the end of April next year. But as you know, these bills carry over, and this is a pre-file point of view. The existing statute covering Susitna provides for all the studies and so on to be in by April 82. And this bill, of course, is by that time, you know, either this bill or a comprehensive bill on energy policy will be adopted. That's what it's all about, but we're acting in the first month of the session.
Excuse me, Senator, in that way then, finance and others would know how to plan as far as expenditure monies, et cetera.
They have a multiple look at it, yes.
I have a related question. If Senate Bills 25 and 26 were enacted in the meantime, would the $48 million appropriation be needed?
Be moved.
We could go directly to the loan program then. Would you object to a provision to that effect being written in?
Not at all. Excuse me. It's been a long day for you, so I was just trying to shortcut it.
Madam Chairman, I have another question. I'm not quite sure what the Senate Bill 26 means in terms of taking effect on different rates. Are the total appropriations to be made out of the 82 fiscal year, or are we appropriating for future legislatures?
No, sir. As I understand it, the act would take effect now with these various stages for appropriation, so that the money would come out of the succeeding fiscal years that it's designated for.
I guess I should address it to Mr. President. Can this legislature appropriate money?
Only for 81 and 82, but you can set up a permanent fund. I'll speak to that.
Thank you very much. Any other questions? Senator Curtula?
It's been a long day for you. You have the bills in detail before you, and there will be a considerable continuation of this hearing tomorrow in Senate Finance. I won't belabor this, except to say that the man most vilified in my childhood, and not to draw any personal parallels, but the man who was the author of REA and TVA, Senator George Norris, when he died, the then administration of opposition to his program put out a postage stamp and commemorative that stated George Norris, the gentle knight of social justice. And I just want to touch base with you to say that with me, this has been an 8-year program. There is ample legislative activity to prove that. We passed a $1 billion revenue bill some many years ago already for this purpose. And myself and the now Lieutenant Governor and Frank Ferguson were paramount and did most of the work on that legislation in that time frame when it had a great deal of support from the then chairman of the now past Commission of Public Works, Mr. Don Harris, who brought up a lot of people from the South 48, particularly the Kaiser aluminum people, and said we'd be delighted to build it for you if we just have half the power. Since most of them have moved to Australia, as you know, or on their way. Remember this. It's something of a patriotic thing, and you've never seen me wave the flag, but to say that energy could run us into World War III when petty tyrants in the Near East control vital resources, and we may have to act in our own limited self-interest in time to save some of those resources. If we develop alternatives, that holocaust, or that potential for holocaust, is relieved. You have the bill again, as I said, and I'm only going to paraphrase a little bit of my formal statement, because I think any statement that's worth making is worth making in a formal way. Again, though, I'll cut it very short, touch a bit on the philosophy. You have the substance before you, even though it's in its infancy, and it's primarily a title and number. There'll be changes. There'll be changes, particularly when it comes to financial decisions. That's where the major changes will be made. You know, and I know, that our public now wants the kind of leadership that would say, we're taking this one-time harvest of oil revenues to build a sound economy forever. And by, I believe that we must, in this year, with the legislature, create what amounts to a long-term investment strategy that will ensure that when the oil is gone, a strong Alaska will remain. That opportunity is open for us. Alaska is rich in energy resources at a time when the world is desperate for energy. And Alaska suddenly has the capital to develop these resources at a time when capital elsewhere is in short supply. No state in history has had the economic opportunity Alaska has in the year 1981. Now, most of us who have lived in Alaska for any length of time are victims of the let others do it mentality. We waited so long for decisions from the Department of Interior, or the Corps of Engineers, this project on Susitna has probably been 40-some years, or the Congress. We cursed and waited so long for the energy companies to go on exploring. We waited for land fees to end and land bills to pass. For so long as we can remember, events have seemed beyond our control. And always we were anchored by decades of unmet needs and chronic shortages of cash. Again, things are now in our control. We don't have to wait for anyone anymore. We can develop all of our hydro resources that are responsibly developed ourselves, with our own funds, and our own time. Can develop the tidal power, the synthetic fuels, and the geothermals, and the other resources also. Obviously, we can build the transportation infrastructure necessary. And we, I believe, can ensure, compared to the time that these come on, any other alternative, we can ensure that every area in Alaska will have cheap power forever. We can build an energy climate that will attract an industrial base. A lot of industry is not. Who would use all the energy? That's a question that's properly asked. If we were to answer the question with conventional cost-benefit study, the results might show an energy supply at the moment far in excess of demand. Let's use our heads. Oil will be at least $50 a barrel within the year. What price will it be 5 to 10 years when much of what we've decided today will be on the line? You know, in the 1960s, a study determined that the Rampart Dam on the Yukon would not be feasible, not for ecological or environmental reasons, but because its power cost would be two mills. That was considered too high a price. That study was made by some of the best minds in America. I don't wish to push Rampart, but of course if it had been built, it would have been coming online shortly. And if in the intervening period, the cost had skyrocketed from 2 mills to the equivalent of $10 a barrel, it would still have been an energy bargain of a kind. Meanwhile, we've watched the American aluminum industry go to Australia because it's just run out of power in the United States. If we develop our energy, there will not be a shortage of users in a world that is energy short, where energy supplies are running out at a time that more and more nations are developing energy-based economies. By building our energy base ourselves, we can control that placement, and in the environmental aspects of the industries that do arrive, we can keep out the black smokestacks today far better than we'd be able to do under pressure of tight budgets and a declining economy at a latter date. You know, we don't have an unlimited supply of money. We're making choices now, and if we're not careful, today's choices will be shortchanged. We don't have a surplus of money. We merely have had a shortage of ideas about how to invest the money in the job of building a better Alaska. I frankly think we should set up this Energy Development Fund. Hydroelectric, of course, is an important part of this program. There are many other projects and many other areas of energy that should be developed. But nations, states, and local governments have a history of competence in the construction and distribution of hydroelectric power. It's not a new thing we have to develop and put to the fore. We have the technicians and we have the in-place mentality and capability to do what has been going on for 100 years and 50 years and so on. It's one type of technology that the government itself seems competent to build and to invest in and to develop. And I can't overly emphasize the fact that we'll stop now, except to say that this is our chance. Even the permanent fund, the cash permanent fund, if we have a shortage of funds later for governmental purposes, somehow those funds will find their way. But you can't start dynamiting the dams and converting them into something else. I just can't overly emphasize the fact that this is one of the very best places, with prudent judgment, environmental standards maintained, for us to put some of the funds that are now available to develop some of the jobs and some of the economy for today and for most of all of the future. It's just a philosophical statement, but I appreciate your time today.
Thank you, Senator Cotillo. That's beautiful.
I would just like to comment that this is the first statement of the kind that I came to the Senate for, because I think that's the kind of philosophical statement of principles that I think is really important as a basis for the individual actions that we take, and we don't see them reflected in the bills that we usually get or in most of the discussions that I have heard so far. I fully agree with Mr. President in the philosophy of getting right with the tribute to George Norris. And I'll lay off with that. I have a couple of very specific technical questions, but I don't want to spoil the mood at this point.
Madam Chairman, just for the record, we've heard a lot of testimony today, and it's obvious that some of the people who are testifying opposed to Senate Bill 8 have not read that bill that was enacted last year in Chapter 169 of the session laws, because there are many, many safeguards in there that were built in specifically, I think, to protect against some of the things that we heard today. And it is not an immediate build and erect bill. All it is a follow-up of that bill that was passed last year, and I think that needs to be said for the record.
Thank you, Senator Gilman. I agree with that, and I think there are some people here, like Roland and Press, that can help with the understanding of those who, in the testimony that I heard, some of them, I did not bother to try to enlighten during this time because our time was so short, and I knew that we had this 3 o'clock, and I was afraid some would figure that they had been denied their right to be heard. But I think it's very important that the philosophy behind this and that the knowledge of what the bills really say be known to the public, because in time to come, I'm sure that our actions here today and in this session and the session to come is going to determine a lot about what happens to us historically down the line, and it's to me one of the biggest concepts we'll see for some time to come. Is there feeling on the part of the committee as to the Senate Bill 8, Senate sponsor substitute for Senate Bill 25 or Senate Bill 26? Or did you want to ask technical questions?
I have one question of Mr. President or Dave, and that has to do with the naming of projects. Why is it necessary to name these projects, number one? And secondly, Dave, you mentioned that dollars would be available for other projects, alternative projects for a given area, if a named project were found to be not feasible. Is that provided someplace specifically?
Yes.
I guess I didn't read the fine print.
Senator Fisher, call your attention to page 5, 4483, 460B is the paragraph that has that provision.
I see. Okay. That's my question. Thank you.
Thank you, Senator Fisher. Any other questions? Thank you, Senator Cotillo.
Thank you. Thank you, Committee.
Chair would entertain a motion.
Madam Chair, I would move that SB 8 sponsor substitute for SB 25 and SB 26 move with individual recommendations.
Is there objection?
Hey, I would like to object for purpose of an amendment.
Yes, we do need an amendment on the bill here.
As I discussed before during Dave's testimony, I think we could help Senate Bill 8 by making it very clear that that appropriation is lapses upon the enactment of Senate Bill 26.
Madam Chair, for the sake of discussion, I'm sure that this is going to be a part of financing's work with this tomorrow and the next day. The actual financial judgments will take place in Finance Committee.
I would testify to that effect if you'd like to.
On that basis, so long as the intent of that is very clear, so that those who follow us and have to deal with the bill know that those behind the bill are agreeable to it, and I have no problem with letting the bill go as is.
And then, if you like, I'll put a letter of intent on the SBA. There is, though, the problem with the typographical typo that we had with the 1 million one that was left out. Do I have a motion to amend to include that?
Let's see, that
page
was
3 of page 1. Between lines 4 and 5.
Is that
a
form
five
of motion?
I suppose.
Is there objection? Without an objection, then, would you change your motion, Senator McKay, to say as amended?
As amended, Madam Chair.
Is there objection? Then so be it. Is there anything else to come before the committee today?
I have one question. What will henceforth happen with similar and related legislation that, for instance, may be introduced at the request of the governor? Will the Finance Committee henceforth deal with all of that, or will that come through here?
It would probably come through here. We could waive on the request of the Finance Committee, or we could take a good look at it. It would be up to the committee.
At that point, if we wanted to, we could look at these bills again in the context of the governor's recommendation.
Well, not necessarily these bills. We could look at the governor's bill, yes. And two of our members are on the Finance Committee, so I'm sure it would not be difficult for us to relay to them any feelings we might have on the matter.
Madam Chair, it's my understanding, too, that the administration is going to unveil their plan at Senate Finance tomorrow.
That's right.
Anything else come before the committee? Thank you for your patience, committee members. Meeting's adjourned.